This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, The Information Advantage. I'm Bill Hammack, substituting for Celeste Quinn. Usually you only hear me for a few minutes on Tuesday mornings talking about engineering and life, but today I take a deeper look at the relationship between technology and society. My guest is a political science professor from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. He writes about a place which has no map, an area he calls Technopolis. And although all of us are citizens of this country, he feels we rarely take a deep look at how modern technology affects us. His goal is to explain the meaning of technology for the way we live, just as Plato and Aristotle ask, what is the best form for a political society? My guest suggests we ask of our high-tech age, what forms of technology are compatible with the kind of society we want to build? He's given us two guidebooks to Technopolis: Autonomous Technology, which studies technology out of control as a theme in political thought, and an elegant and delightful book called The Whale and the Reactor, subtitled The Search for Limits in an Age of High Technology. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL Live via the Internet at www.will.uiuc.edu. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Langdon Winner.
Hello, Bill. It's good to be with you.
Hello, Langdon. What I want to know first is, where does the title The Whale and the Reactor come from?
Well, the title comes from an experience I had many years ago in my hometown, which is San Luis Obispo, California. I had left that town to go off and study politics and eventually ended up writing a lot about technology and politics, large-scale complex systems, military systems, and so forth. And I happened to be taking my car down to the beach where I used to go as a little boy and saw a sign which said, "Tours to Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant." So I got on the bus and took this tour, which went up a rather steep mountain, and then just as we were getting to the first vista of the nuclear power plant on this beautiful sunny day, off in the Pacific Ocean, a California gray whale surfaced and spouted. And it was kind of an epiphany for me, which said basically, where have you been? Everything you've been writing about has been right here in your home ground. That was the title of the book, The Whale and the Reactor Juxtaposed.
So I gather when you looked at that enormous whale, you saw kind of a timeless ecosystem. And in the reactor, you saw a human-made technological object.
Right. Now, and right where I had grown up. Mm-hmm. And I had gone off to study. I'd been in the Pentagon. I had been in computing centers. I had been studying technology and how it changes the world. And the insight was that it was all right back where I had come from originally, all of the questions that had always interested me.
Well, I think when many people would look at that reactor, they would see the inevitable progress of technology, that it's being like a steamroller. It has its own logic. It's unmediated by any other influences, a kind of technological determinism. Is there such a thing?
Well, I think actually the case of nuclear power is quite good, because there was a rhetoric that surrounded it for a good long while, proclaiming it to be the inevitable next step. But economic and political problems arose really in the late 60s and 1970s, and then some events like the accident at Three Mile Island. And instead of scheduling new plants to be built, there were dozens and even hundreds scheduled for construction in energy company plans. Our society decided to put it on hold. And for me, that's a lesson that the things that are proclaimed to be inevitable sometimes experience historical contingencies that sort of put them off the track of things that are bound to happen. So one of the things that I try to do in my work is both study the language of inevitability and of autonomous, unstoppable change. While looking at what underlies all of that and alternatives for thinking about these, what turn out to be choices that somebody makes somewhere.
Well, one of the things that you emphasize in your work, rather than a kind of determinism, is that there's a mix of really social factors and technical factors. And you use the example of Robert Moses. Can you tell me, what did Robert Moses do?
Well, Robert Moses was the great technocrat and reformer who eventually became a kind of authoritarian bureaucratic figure in the state where I now live, which is New York. And he took control of transit, parks division, a whole bunch of state authorities, and began to essentially redesign the fabric of life, particularly around New York City. And one of the things that he did was to build a series of bridges over the Long Island Expressway at the same time that he was building beaches, new beaches, for the white middle class to attend. And according at least to a testimony given by New York planner Lee Koppelman, what Moses did was to build the bridges low so that buses could not pass. And that meant that certain kinds of people in the greater New York area found it very difficult to get to places like Jones Beach. And this is just one, actually, of there are a whole bunch of examples from the career of Robert Moses, where he tried to build a world that was marked by differences of class, implicitly of racial community and the like, to build a well-structured New York that would include the automobile at its center.
So one of your points with that story, isn't it, is to mix in all of these factors and really show that technology is not inevitable and that technical decisions become very quickly political decisions.
That's true. And my entree into a world that's mainly dominated by engineers, businessmen and economists is to go in the direction of my area of education and study, which was political history, political philosophy. So really, all I do is look at things that people call technologies. I look at them as political practices and institutions. And I say, you know, well, how can we describe these institutions? Are they the kinds of institutions that we want? Do they distribute power well, for example? What are the alternatives in, let's say, the building of these things, the design of these things? But when one does this, when one tries to look at technological devices and systems as political things, and you begin, let's say, talking in the way that Plato and Socrates and Aristotle talked about political systems, people say, uh-oh, you're just anti-technology, which, of course, isn't the point at all. Plato was not anti-politics. He believed in a particular kind of politics and advocated it, but his writings were not to say we should abolish the polis.
Mm-hmm. Langdon, I have a caller on line one that I would like to chat with. Line one?
Yes, hello.
Yes, you have a question?
Are you familiar with the book and the concept of natural capitalism?
Oh, yes, definitely. I very much admire both the book, and I think the idea is quite fertile.
Langdon, could you
be thinking about it?
Could you define natural capitalism for us? What is the caller referring to here?
Well, is the caller still on?
Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead. Either one of you.
Let the caller define it.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, to the extent that I understand it, it saying that you know, the next wave of the Industrial Revolution or technological revolution will be one in which both the technology and the economy are designed along, you know, parallel to the natural systems, and that by doing so, you know, will not only not be polluting, but will actually be much more profitable and efficient.
Yes. Now, the only thing I would disagree with at all in your statement, which is quite clear and exactly right, is the in the very first sentence you said, this is the system that will be coming into being. I think one could say it ought to be, and it's a possibility. But the will suggests, you know, that this is sort of the inevitable next stage, and I think that's not the case. These things are being contested. There are proponents for living more lightly on the earth and treating natural systems with care as one devises new ways of living and the technologies that that serve them.
But
we could go in quite opposite directions, and it's by no means clear that our society is going to retool in the ways that the authors of that book, Hawken and Amory and Hunter Lovins, specify.
Well, I tend to agree with your assessment, although the reason I said will is because they kind of state this with a certain inevitability, at least
right.
in the long run, because they say that the companies and businesses that don't go along these lines simply won't be able to compete.
Yeah. Well, that's a testable hypothesis. In the short run, I think it's entirely possible to go in directions contrary to the ones they spell out, compete quite well and profit quite well, although the planet will suffer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you.
Langdon, I want to probe a little bit some of these different reactions to technology. One of the things that you've written about is something called a remote encoding center. You visited one in the 1990s, U.S. postal facility. Could you describe what you saw there?
Well, this was a center. Actually, I can even sort of see it out my window here in Troy, New York,
mm-hmm.
where postal employees would sit in by the, there must have been a couple of hundred people in the room, staring at screens, and what they were doing was reading envelopes on their screens that had been misaddressed or were so clearly or so poorly addressed in their handwritten form that their job was to try to read them and decide where the envelopes should go.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a form of a kind of industrial production, you know, this kind of mindless work, hour after hour after hour after hour, which was made possible by long lines of communication, digital technology, the latest in electronics. These were the role for humans in this process was they were able to, in the last juncture in the system, read the envelopes that computers could not decipher. So I describe it as a kind of, you know, bureaucratized, dead-end job. I'm not even sure whether this center exists anymore because it was the kind of thing that was kind of last vestige of the digital age.
It was almost a high-tech sweatshop, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh, exactly.
And
yeah.
And I believe you described them as the people as listening on headphones with Walkmans, piles of batteries around, each in their own world.
That's right. Well, they were looking at these envelopes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's similar to a lot of high-tech sweatshops, the these warehouses where people do telemarketing, for example, in a variety of ways. At very low wages, you know, it's a kind of dreary work that is the dark underside of what's often hyped as a new world of exciting, flexible work brought to us by the new communications.
Well, one might look at this, though, and say, look, these are very well-paid people. I believe at the time it was $12 an hour. This was the early 90s. They're actually getting a fairly large wage for the skill level of the job. Did you feel conflicted looking at that? I mean, it seems like there's a positive to it also.
Yeah, and I knew some people actually who worked there. Mm-hmm. One of them eventually left and is now an ordinary postal clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And what she told me was that she just couldn't stand the kind of human isolation sitting there hour after hour, right next to people she couldn't talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So she's much happier, you know, selling postage stamps and putting packages in the mail from behind a desk where she at least gets to interact with human beings.
But the focus there in looking at the positive part of that is it's a solely economic perspective, increasing
yeah.
the median income. So what, in your view, is lacking in this conventional description of technological change?
Well, I think the thing that's lacking is an attention to two things. One of them was mentioned by the previous caller, which is the ecological and environmental context in which these systems are situated. And the other one, I would just say, has to do with the quality of everyday life, particularly the kinds of activities that get us outside our homes and into the world of other people, the world of civic culture. And I think that's where a lot of the new electronic technologies are highly problematic in the form that they are taking. They tend to, unfortunately, further isolate us or glue us to cathode ray tubes and take us away from the world of human interactions.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a group of people that are often called cyber libertarians.
Yep.
And what they see in technology is a utopia. They're ecstatically enthusiastic about free markets, about freedom, creating wealth. And one of their main disciples, Nicholas Negroponte, says, "I do believe that being digital is positive. It can flatten organizations, globalize society, decentralize control, and help harmonize people." It's almost a new age form of a conventional conservative message.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find this message too optimistic?
Well, again, one of the things that bothers me about it is there's a kind of sense that the very adoption of a particular kind of technology will inevitably have certain consequences, that we'll be able to live without bureaucracies, that we'll be in better touch with our friends and families and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a promise that has been made ever since the early 19th century, where it was attached to things like new waterways, railroads, factories, telephone, telegraph. I mean, you sort of go through the whole list. There have always been publicists like Negroponte who believe that the next great technology will be a source of community formation and democracy. And the feeling that this is going to happen automatically just by adopting a bunch of equipment, I think, deflects us from dealing with the choices that might make the beautiful predictions actually come true.
Mm-hmm.
For example, 20 years ago, we had predictions of the electronic cottage from Alvin Toffler and others,
mm-hmm.
which were very similar to Negroponte's view. And what we find today is that if you go back and look at those predictions of happier democratic communities, they haven't really happened. And the reason for that is people have not thoughtfully, in my view, attended to the design, the configuration of, let's say, a whole package of related systems and social forms. For example, the relationship between automobile commuting and how we communicate.
So are you saying that the kind of things that we're hearing from these cyber libertarians, for lack of a better word,
yeah.
Is the same story we've heard again and again in the 19th century, perhaps as trains spread across the nation, we would hear that new things were going to happen and reinvigorate democracy and this kind of thing. Is there a cycle here? Do we hear this again and again?
Yes, and the thing that happens is that the predictions from the previous generation are never... no one's ever held to account for them. So you have this recurring wave, and it's especially prominent in American thought,
mm-hmm.
of a kind of sublime sense that society is going to be saved and uplifted by the next great technology.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear reports that, you know, the computer in the early 1980s, the personal computer, was going to save education. By the end of the 1980s, everyone realized American education was in crisis. But in the early 1990s, along came the Internet. So now it was going to be the Internet that would save education. But no one went back to look at the very same kinds of claims and ideas that were presented 20 years earlier. So the learning curve, I would say, social learning curve about technology and social renewal is pretty much flat. No one ever seems to learn anything or remember very much. So we make the same mistakes over and over again.
But on the opposite side of these cyber libertarians are the dystopians, and I'm thinking of the French philosopher Jacques Ellul, whose work seems to have influenced yours.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a very negative view, arguing that technology, or what he called technique, was going to take away our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And now my sense is that you're somewhere between these cyber libertarians and the dystopians like Ellul. Is that correct?
Well, I take a different tack, and mm-hmm. I would say that Jacques Ellul, if you read his
thanks for correcting my French
carefully, what he's saying is that he's offering a challenge.
Sure.
And he's saying, here's the challenge that I'm holding out to you. Here's where I see things going.
Mm-hmm.
That people would, for example, spend 5 to 8 hours a day just staring at television tubes and allow propaganda to pour into their lives and so forth, to live in very regimented ways. And he wasn't saying, you know, there is no choice but this. He's saying, well, this is the flow of events, and human beings need to affirm their freedom and make decisions about other ways of going about things. And I think that my sense is, as a thinker about politics is full of openness and contingency, the good news about any substantial technological change is that the world's going to be very different. It's not going to be the same as it was 5 years ago, and 10 years out, a lot will have changed. And when things are changing, there's opportunities to intervene and say, well, here's how we would like it to be, which is why I'm a big proponent of much broader democratic participation in making choices. I think the more people have a voice, the better institutions in technology we're likely to get.
Now, one of the things he did was really to define technology. That's not even fair. He talked about technique.
Yeah.
And he included almost every way that we quantify things as part of the technological revolution or change. It was an enormously broad view.
Yes.
Do you define technology in the same way?
No, I don't. But the differences, I think, don't much matter. As I say, I define the main questions as those of the interweaving of instrumental devices and human activities and social structures is the key to my thinking, and that's where my focus rests. But I think the great insight of this French thinker, Jacques Ellul, was to notice that really in sort of the middle and late 18th century, there was a profound change that swept through Western civilization in which ways of affirming value and making judgments and drawing limits changed. One of the ways that he put it was that it was once the case that technique was a part of culture, a part of civilization, and it was constrained by things like the church, the guilds, the medieval guilds. It was constrained by institutions that were quite strong and which were in some way, they were at least very careful about which kinds of innovation would be allowed to spread. And what he argued was, in the 18th century, la technique, which he defined as the endless quest for the best way of doing things. You know, you want more from less. You want more output for fewer inputs and so forth. That became the standard for judging everything. And he meant literally every human activity. So the reason that he looked at, you know, social practice very broadly, including things like our tendency to exercise, how we view our sexual performance, let's say, how we look at what goes in a schoolroom or a university classroom. What Ellul says was, we are now hopelessly committed to a single-minded view of the world in which la technique is the way we make judgments. One of his messages is, unless you can find other ways to make strong judgments, If you can't draw upon other, let's say, wellsprings of inspiration and meaning, then the endless extension of a kind of technocratic world is what we'll get.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Langdon Winner. We're probing the question, what forms of technology are compatible with the kinds of society we wish to build? He shares his thoughts on this question in his elegant book, The Whale and the Reactor. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Remember also that you can listen to this interview live on the webpage at www.will.uiuc.edu. So with our French thinker, he eventually took, or was a priest, took a theologian, had a religious basis to make those decisions.
Yes.
And he laid out that many of these political factors that are important. The essence of your work is to develop a political philosophy of technology.
Yes.
And you point out how choices about technology are really choices about the world that we want to create, and that they have an impact on power, on liberty, on justice, on order.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key elements of the political philosophy, then, that you are advocating?
Well, there are many, but I think in the wake of the attack mm-hmm. on the World Trade Center and Pentagon and its ramifications for the airline industry and so forth, the one, I think, very visible element in the sort of the moral and political complexion of technological systems, I think, centers on the question of trust. You know, for the modern age, throughout the modern age, we have built rather complicated, long-linked, tightly coupled technological systems in energy, water supply, industrial production, transportation, military systems, and so forth. A lot of these, if you think about it, and it's perfectly clear after the World Trade Center disaster, a lot of these were based on a certain kind of trust, which is to say people felt they could interact with and use these systems. They trusted them to work. And in an open and free society like ours, the systems themselves were implicitly based on a kind of trust, which is that people would not act destructively.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at technologies and look around the world, you know, the phone lines, the electrical power lines, the water systems, the radio tower for this broadcast, I mean, in many ways, they're just stark naked out in the open. The reason they are that way, Bill, is that we have trusted people to accept them and to, you know, sort of not disrupt their workings. And it was, you know, a kind of vile, I would say, stroke of genius. I think it's the most horrible thing I have ever imagined, actually, that people could come up with using box cutters and a boarding pass to ram together two technological systems, the high-rise building and the ordinary domestic jet airplane. Right,
mm-hmm.
And I think around the country these days, people are saying, well, what are we going to do about this kind of freedom that we have? Don't we need to be better policed? What should we do to make sure our systems are secure? So here you have some of the most consequential questions about the relationship of technology to our freedom and to everyday life that that one can conceive of. So, you know, all one has to do right now in America is follow the headlines to see, for example, debates in Congress about anti-terrorism measures that will subject us to various kinds of surveillance, curtail our liberties, and so forth. These are the matters, I think, right now that are among the most crucial things that we all need to think about.
So we've kind of gone over the indictment, if you will, of the which is too strong a word, but we certainly have got your point that we should look at technology differently, and that we do have to blend technical decisions and political decisions.
Right.
Do you come back, though, and give your own political philosophy of how to deal with these?
Yeah, well, I'm a kind of participatory Democrat.
Okay.
I believe in the use of public resources, and that might include government tax money, to help foster more convivial linkages between individuals and the communities in which they are situated, for example. I can imagine a technological civilization which is based on ecologically responsible principles, practices of social justice in which there's a kind of deliberate attempt to equalize to a considerable degree the kinds of resources and technological devices that people are able to use. And I am also a strong believer in community life, intelligible communities in which people are able and encouraged to participate, and in the creation of public spaces where people are able to meet, talk, make plans with each other in ways that remove them, at least in that part of their lives, from this kind of inward-looking individuality or sort of tight inward-looking family. So I'm a proponent of participation, decentralization, community life, increasing involvement in the localities where people find themselves.
Well, one of the answers to that, or responses, would be a conventional wisdom that we live in an information age where we communicate back and forth very quickly. In fact, there's nearly a romantic view that information is all-powerful and all-important. Can you dissect the assumptions that underlie this viewpoint?
Well, I think that one of the problems with that viewpoint is that it tends to take one away from one's immediate physical and social surroundings into a kind of very extended way of living, in which selfhood, I think, becomes fragmented and dispersed, and in which one's responsibilities and obligations to others who were, let's say, right outside the window are attenuated. There's been a tendency among people who've celebrated cyberspace to say, oh, you know, I have found community in a way that's truly global. So I'm in touch with fly fishermen or gays and lesbians or whoever one's group happens to be. People are far more friendly online than they are, you know, where I'm living. And I think that is a kind of excuse to withdraw from the kinds of commitments that real communities involve. And I'm not saying people should disconnect from, let's say, internet chat rooms and email and so forth. But I think they should look at the consequences of their online habits and their electronic communications more directly in the localities and regions where they live. And I think at present we're not doing a very good job at finding a healthy balance between, let's say, global and local.
Well, one of the things that people feel is that the assumptions here are that people are bereft of information, and that information is knowledge and knowledge is power, and that increasing access to this information enhances democracy and social power.
Mm-hmm.
And are you saying that those assumptions are not necessarily true?
Well, there are people that think that's the case. As a political scientist, however, I tend to look at rather tangible measurements of whether democracy is working or not. Access to information is just one element of what might be a healthy political society for its citizens. And unfortunately, in America, we find that voting in elections has declined and is now usually in most elections, well below 50%. By most standard measures of the extent to which people are aware of and are active participants in civic culture, the news isn't good either, and I would offer in testimony the book by Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, which traces the decline of people's involvement in churches, local civic groups, voluntary associations of all kinds since World War II. You may recall that Alexis de Tocqueville visited America in the early 19th century and wrote a book called Democracy in America. Mm-hmm. And he one of the things that he said was that what makes the country great is the sort of vitality of voluntary associations, as he called them. Well, as social scientists study that realm these days, the voluntary associations that sort of have traditionally made up community life in most parts of the country are struggling, and they're sort of on the ropes. And the creation of the online world, in which there's lots of information and access to information, hasn't changed that. And one hypothesis is that what people have been doing is substituting electronic communications for anything like active political life, active community life, that which is to say, perhaps people these days are happy monitoring public affairs, but don't feel they have any responsibility to try to shape those affairs.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a little different tack now, because I think I've given the impression by my questioning that you're a dyed-in-the-wool Luddite or interested in returning to the 19th century, and I want to set the record straight. You've certainly been part of our technological age. For example, you worked as a rock music critic, contributing editor at Rolling Stone in the late 1960s and early 70s, and certainly rock music is the most dependent on technology. Did that experience as a rock critic affect your thoughts about technology at all?
Well, it certainly affected my sense of the context in which these things take place. Mm-hmm. I was interested in rock music as sort of a connection between musicians and audiences and broader worldly questions, personal questions and social mm-hmm. questions. And then as I was writing for Rolling Stone, in came the music industry, the dominant player of which at the time has now sort of merged into what's, Time Warner, AOL, and so forth. And they have a totally different way of understanding what's at issue, which is they want market share, they want control of consumer choices, they want to make sure that the dollars roll in. And this is quite different from the view back in the late 60s, early 70s, people like me and Real Marcus and Lester Bangs, it was sort of, what was the soul of America?
Mm-hmm.
Where were we headed? And what did the music have to say about this? Which artists were helping us live through these experiences in ways that were meaningful? And this was not, I discovered, the take that the music industry, and now it's sort of become the mass media industry, which, by the way, includes the Internet as its latest component.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so in that context, I think it's very difficult for ordinary people to find roles for themselves, identities for themselves, which are anything other than as consumers. What should I buy? What mm-hmm. should I own? Mm-hmm. And that, for that reason, I find the technologies that are incorporated into the world of entertainment rather debilitating, rather than liberate people or make them truly independent. They enslave them in certain kinds of patterns that are controlled from corporate boardrooms.
Well, let me use the Internet to continue proving that you are part of our age. At your website, It's has even streaming video.
Yeah. Well, I invite people to go look at it.
Well, they can reach it in two ways. One, www.rpi.edu/tildewinner, W-I-N-N-E-R.
Yeah.
And at my website, engineerguy.com, there's a link at the very top, and it'll be up there all week.
Yeah, and it's a satire of distance education.
Well, let's talk about that. You have something on there called the Automatic Professor Making Machine. Could you tell us?
It's just the Automatic Professor Machine.
Automatic Professor Machine. Could you tell us what that is?
Well, I was involved in discussions about this emerging industry known as distance education.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go around giving talks about this, and I said, what's the value of an education? What do we know about how education works? And one day I decided that I was running into lots of opposition from people who were either in universities or schools and are very gung-ho about the new electronics. And so what I decided to do was to take their rhetoric and their vision and their ways of presenting what education is about, take all their assumptions and push them over the top. So in this little skit, I come out as Langdon Winner,
mm-hmm.
and then I introduce my alter ego, who is a slimy Silicon Valley entrepreneur named L.C. Winner, who's the CEO of a business firm, which is in the distance education business. And so L.C. comes out, and with a complete straight face, a lot of enthusiasm, describes this the monstrous world of distance education. And it's about 20 minutes long, and it sort of takes you to through increasing levels of absurdity.
Well, you have formed a sham corporation called EduSham Corp.
Right.
A company that markets education products.
Well, L.C. Winner prefers to pronounce it EduSham. It's more elegant. It's vaguely British, but it's the Educational Smart Hardware Alma Mater Incorporated,
well,
yes.
A reminder to our listeners, you can either go to my webpage, engineerguy.com, or to Langdon's, www.rpi.edu. /tildewinner, W-I-N-N-E-R, and look at that. We have just a minute or so left.
No.
I'd like to take a caller on line one. We have a caller who's been waiting for a while. Go ahead. Hello?
I'm going to make my comments very brief.
Thank you.
It's very helpful to talk about the erosion of trust and freedom and creative ways that we can cope with the situation. Thanks for this opportunity, and I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Langdon, you've touched on that. One of the interesting things to me is in the book, The Technological Society, this was pretty much, I think, spelled out that this would happen. But are you worried about our freedoms eroding with face-it technologies?
Yes. I mean, we have things like these surveillance cameras in public, internet surveillance. I think right now we're in sort of a panic phase following the attack of September 11th. And I think it's very important for people to follow legislation and other public policies taking shape in Washington and elsewhere, and ask the question, well, what's really needed for security and what is something far more menacing and unneeded?
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about specifically a thing like this face-it technology, which actually photographs people and is able with a computer to recognize or identify them?
Yeah, well, I think that it's a totally unwelcome intrusion in public life, where I think we ought to feel free and open and not feel that the Big Brother is looking over our shoulders. The idea that as you walk down the street, your face is being scanned and then fed into a database of arrest warrants, I think is exactly the wrong kind of assumption to make about American citizens.
Well, Langdon, we're reaching a technological limit here. We're at the end of our time. Thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you, Bill. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Langdon Winner, author of The Whale and the Reactor, A Search for Limits in an Age of High Technology.